tonight on the Steve and Dan podcast, Steve and Dan discuss the first half of Season 5 of The Walking Dead. Hi, I'm Steve.
Hi, I'm Dan, and welcome to episode 10 of the Steve and Dan podcast. Tonight we're going to talk about The Walking Dead Season 5, the first half of the season, roundup.
Okay, so we basically had three storylines. We had the Terminus escape and fallout, which combined with the church and Father Gabriel. We had the Atlanta part with Beth and eventually where everybody comes together. And then we had the Abraham and Eugene expedition. Okay, so we started off with three of, for my money, the best episodes we've had in The Walking Dead.
Yeah, easily.
Easily, yeah. They were fantastic episodes. The opening sequence, the whole first hour of the escape from Terminus was awesome.
Yeah.
With kick-ass Carol and increasingly kick-ass Rick and Daryl looking really angsty and awesome and Glenn having existential moments and just lots of awesomeness. And there was blood and there was gore and there was Gareth being a bureaucrat. And yeah, it was a fantastic episode. And the stinger at the end, you know, we see Morgan coming out of the woods. Fantastic way to end the episode because there's no telling where he's coming from or why he's there. Although we know he's on their trail. He's definitely in the right area. He saw the Terminus sign, right? The no sanctuary sign that Rick had scraped the mud over, which tells us timeliness, like time-wise, he was pretty close after them because obviously the rain hasn't washed the mud away.
Nice details.
Yeah, it's a pretty important thing, I think. Episode 2, what do we have there?
The two main things that happen in Strangers are we get introduced to Gabriel and we also, the group finally gets its face off with Gareth and the gang.
Yes, who are now referring to themselves as the Hunters, which of course is a, for anybody who's a reader of the comic book, is a familiar name. And man, are they creepy. I mean, it's as bad as Terminus was, I think that, you know, having civilized cannibals as opposed to feral cannibals is somehow preferable. Maybe neither is really preferable, I suppose.
The kind of thinking man's cannibal, you know? Yeah, it made him much more creepy than the claimers, you know?
The claimers are just a bunch of, you know, a bunch of good old boys.
Yeah.
Bunch of good old boys. Yeah, no, not quite Dukes of Hazzard. They were certainly better written.
Yeah, those guys are nasty. If they turned out to be cannibals, it wouldn't have been, because they were kind of cartoonish. You got that leering, awful rapist guy.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking right now? Daisy Duke as a cannibal? Oh. Boss Hog.
Lovely. Yeah, they were just caricatures. I didn't mind the Claimers storyline. It was good because you got to see Rick tear someone's throat out.
Well, and it was an impetus too, right? It was a way for Daryl to find another way of surviving, which obviously he then values Rick and the group much more because there's a personal connection there. Whereas with the Claimers, it was just all about mine. It's like the seagulls in Finding Nemo, right? Which doesn't carry a lot of depth, as you say. Caricatures is correct.
And they were playing with the kind of idea that we have with Daryl anyway, that he's sort of a hillbilly, sort of a rough and ready type of person, and you know, maybe he would have been more at home in the Claimers.
Certainly back in the Merle days, yeah, for sure he would have been, right?
Yeah, and the boss of the Claimers, I can't remember his name, but he seemed decent, you know. He kind of cared for Daryl and he was looking out for him, so they had a little bit of potential, but they just turned out to be, you know, brutal, just evil bastards.
And interestingly enough, now that you bring that up about the taking care of Daryl thing, I didn't think of this until this very moment, but I think there's a real resonance with the way that the head of the Claimers treated Daryl and the way Officer Lerner was treating Beth.
Yeah.
In the sense of like trying to kind of coach and coax and create, you know, a subservient person, somebody who's going to follow you because they're now loyal, right? Creating loyalty in the person through.
Yeah. No, ownership of people has been quite a theme so far in this season.
Yeah. And then we see the way the group reacts to that attempt to control them in Four Walls and a Roof, the third episode, which is when they deal with the Hunters. Now, we should point out at the end of episode 2 as well, that's when Daryl and Carol take off, right? That they see that car go by. That sets up the second main story arc, which is the Atlanta section.
Yeah.
So, yeah, episode 3, for my money, was as good as the first episode and was just one of the most gory and intense scenes I've ever seen on television.
The first three were incredible. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, then we took a bit of a nosedive. And I'm not going to blame Emily Kinney.
Nah, rest in peace and all that. Yeah, it did slow down. It was necessary to set up the hospital. It had to happen.
It just seemed a bit uneven after we had those three very exciting episodes. We couldn't possibly have 8 adrenaline-busting episodes, right? It's just not going to work. We would fatigue.
Yeah.
But I felt that it was somewhat of a jarring pace change.
Yeah, a few people people mentioned that it almost felt like one of the webisodes or some kind of fan fiction production, basically set in the same loose world. I mean, the problem with Slaptown is that you're mixing too many new elements in one go, all right? We've got Beth. Now, we haven't had Beth at all for a while because she's been missing for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You have a completely new setting, the hospital, and it's an interior, right? So it feels different. It feels unusual. And you've got a bunch of new characters. I mean, I thought that the episode was a little bit weak for a few reasons, but I think it was really challenging to make it congruent with the rest of the season in any case.
True enough. And it did give us the opportunity to have our very first Oscar winner on the show, didn't it?
Oh, we did? Who is that?
I'm pretty sure. The girl that played Joan.
Ah,
the
woman
played
Joan.
Who is a New Zealand actress who was, I believe, did she win for The Whale Rider?
I don't know if she won. I remember you mentioning that she won.
Keisha Castle Hughes. I'm just having a look. Nominated for one Oscar. So she was nominated. I think she was the youngest at the time. She was either the youngest or the second youngest woman ever nominated for a Best Actress Oscar.
Hmm.
She was our first, at least, Oscar nominee that we saw physically on the show. Hmm. Yay, we're going up.
Is she the first one to be in the show?
As far as I know. Now, this would be an awesome piece of trivia if anybody out there listening to this knows. Otherwise, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah.
But
I got to admit, I haven't seen a single actor or actress in Walking Dead who I'd seen previously. I know that you know Abraham.
Well, Abraham's been in a few things. Dale, man. Like, if you look at Dale's IMDb charts, there are movies you've seen. For example, have you seen The Shawshank Redemption?
Yeah. Is he in that?
Yeah, he's in that, I believe.
Huh.
I could be wrong. He's either that or The Green Mile. He's one of those two, and I'm sure you've seen both of those.
Yeah. Oh, Lawrence Gilliard Jr. I forgot. I've seen him in The Wire.
Oh, that's true. And
yeah,
same with
Father Gabriel's figure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm just going to pull up the magic of IMDb here, and we're going to look up Dale while you tell us about the fifth episode.
Self-help.
Yes.
Yeah, this is when we move over to the Eugene and Abraham side of the storyline.
Interesting episode.
Yeah, what later becomes known as the Greatham Group. It was, again, a kind of a quieter one. This is when they have left, and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do, and they end up spending some time in a town. They go to the bookstore. They manage to find the fire truck, which is the vehicle that they stick with for the rest of the first half of the season.
Yep.
Yeah, a lot of kind of pensive stuff, a lot of story building. We get a lot more attention on Eugene and Abraham. I believe we get Abraham's backstory here, is it?
We do. We get Abraham's backstory with his family when the episode opens on him absolutely destroying one of his former groupmates with a tin can to the face.
Right.
And then his wife being just so afraid of that unbridled rage that she runs away with the two children.
Yeah.
Just to go back to Dale for a second, Jeffrey DeMunn is the actor's name, and he was actually in both The Green Mile and The Shawshank Redemption. So you've definitely seen him in other things.
Huh.
He's been acting for donkey's years. His first credits go back to 1978, so he's been around a long time. So yeah, there are a few actors that have definitely been around. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not they've ever been nominated for an Oscar, that's another thing. And he hasn't. He's been nominated for a Primetime Emmy, which is the as anybody in North America who watches the Emmys knows, are the bad Emmys. You know, they're not the good Emmys. The Primetime Emmys are daytime Emmys. So we probably did a soap, but we won't talk about that.
No.
Okay, so yeah, we're getting Abraham's backstory.
I think it ends when they hit that farm, which is full of stinking walkers, and they're not sure where to go.
Yeah, that's right. The episode ends with kind of a stalemate. They're stuck on this road with no way to go but back, and Abraham refuses to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And he's getting pretty pushy.
And then we get to episode 6, Consumed, which is all about Daryl and Carol.
Pretty good episode, although kind of repetitive in the motif sense.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit slow in the middle. A lot of bonding stuff. You get the flashback of Carol leaving by herself, and then you get Carol and Daryl driving into Atlanta, hiding out in the buildings. You know, kind of figuring out slowly what's going on with Beth in the hospital.
Get a little bit of backstory on Carol. I mean, that we didn't have before. The idea that she's been in a woman's shelter before because of Ed, her husband. I remembered his name for some reason at this point, but yeah, Ed, who was abusive towards her. She had tried to go, but she didn't stay. Remember, she mentions that. You know what else we get in this episode that we've never had before, and that a lot of people been asking for? Daryl and Carol in bed together.
Be it a bunk bed.
Yeah, there's no sexual tension whatsoever. They lie down on the bed together beside each other, but they're just sitting there.
And we also get some good smoking going on in this scene, in this episode.
A lot of fire. The fire motif throughout. Almost hitting us over the head, you know, with the symbolism, but at the same time it works, I think.
And it puts us at the hospital. And right at the end of this episode is when Carol gets sideswiped by the car, and it sends Noah and Daryl back to meet the group, and everything's kind of starting to tidy up.
We also have the miraculously upright landing van, which we'll discuss later.
Oh, God. Okay, so they're moving on to Crust. Crust, we are back with the group at the church.
Daryl is back.
With Noah. He spilled the beans. They're hatching a plan. They're deciding what they're going to do.
I have a cunning plan.
At this point, Bob Lampson turns up. They set the trap for him, or Noah sets the trap for him in some kind of warehouse on the outskirts of Atlanta. And this is how we entice the three cops away, who are going to be used to bargain with Dawn to get back Beth.
I should also point that Lamson is played by Maximiliano Hernandez, who people who follow shows such as The Walking Dead and other genre shows might know better as Agent Sitwell from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So he's kind of getting a name for himself amongst genre fans, and he'll probably start showing up at Comic Cons anytime.
Mm.
Yeah, but he plays a pretty interesting character for a guy that's only in basically for the one episode.
Even if his storyline kind of wasn't towards the end of his life, I felt that he was pretty good.
Well, you got to give the guy some slack. He, you know, he had a broken back.
Yeah.
But, okay, so you've got an interesting thing. I just want to point out, too, that you've got Daryl outside in front of the church with pipe organs, right? With the pipes from the pipe organ.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking, okay, Morgan's around. We know Morgan's around. Can you just picture Morgan walking up on that church and seeing this really crude kind of, you know, keep the zombies out trap with the pipe organ pipes? And he's going to look at that and go, God, amateurs, amateur hour. These guys don't know what they're doing. You remember back to this third season when Rick goes and finds him,
mm-hmm.
and he had that whole street completely done up.
Yeah, he's got traps. A compound.
He's very good.
He's
very
incredible. Good.
Yeah, so he's going to see that and just think amateur hour. He might just turn around and walk away.
Yeah, zombies are very simple machine. Yes. You know? All you need to do is set up some sort of pit system that just funnels them into the pit. You know, it would work.
That sounds an awful lot like what was happening with the group that the governor took over.
Yeah, they had those huge pits on the floor where they'd collect them and round them up.
They'd eventually pile up. I mean, if you had a horde coming, see, you know, the Atlanta horde, the one that follows that airplane or that helicopter in the very first season, if that came towards you, it would fill the pit and they just walk over top. It'd be like army ants crossing a creek, right? The army ants, basically, they use their bodies. Sort of like that scene in World War Z where they're going over that wall and they're piling up on top of each other.
That was the only good thing in that entire movie.
That's why they put it in the trailer.
The whole movie was just Brad Pitt just apologizing.
He was playing a Canadian, obviously.
And also, do you know what I would do? I would just get as many bells or like loud things as possible, attach them to some walkers, trap those walkers, and just let them make a hell of a lot of noise and draw all the rest around them, you know?
Oh, totally. It would make sense. Which actually brings up another one of the problems I'm going to be talking about later, power generation at the hospital, but we'll discuss that later. So we've got one more episode, and that was, of course, the
Coda.
Again, for my money, return to the form of the first three episodes.
Big time, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic episode.
Yeah, the first half of the season started strong. It didn't dip too much, you know. We had a couple of subpar episodes, probably two, I'd say. Two were kind of quite dull, but the rest were just fine.
But even for subpar, we're talking still, if I was a grading man, which I am on my blog, yeah, it would be a B, you know, B. Not even lower than that.
I'd throw out Slab Town as a C+, B-, even though it was important. I didn't enjoy it too much. Which one was the one that we said was stupid? I think that was Cross, wasn't it?
It had some really stupid moments. Okay, maybe that's a C+, that one. That had some bad moments.
But it was entertaining. Like, Slab Town was a little bit dumb, and it was only kind of half entertaining. All right, so that's the quick recap of the first half of the season.
Not so quick recap, but we should perhaps say. But
right, yeah. So we're going to talk about new returning characters. Father Gabriel, probably Seth Gilliam, the main, yeah, the biggest new character, I think.
Well experienced. I mean, you've seen him on The Wire and on Oz and amongst other shows.
Seth Gilliam, yeah, he's a good actor,
and he definitely looks like he's part of the group now. By the end of the 8th.
We already have, I wouldn't say a pacifist, but we already have a non-combatant in Eugene.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not entirely original, but it's kind of refreshing to find someone who's not willing to just go out and start stabbing heads.
Although I would argue that by the end of episode 8, he's now ready to become a combatant.
He seems to be on the way, but he's still at least conflicted. No one else has any qualms or concerns about slaughtering zombies anymore. We've got Morgan, who's shown a little bit of tenderness towards them, but otherwise everyone's just happy to treat them as part of the scenery.
It's true. Then we have Noah, who comes from the hospital. Now, he was a bit of an interesting character. I wasn't sure about him at first, but I think I like him at this point. He was actually, the way he was willing to sacrifice his own freedom for the rest of the group and for Beth's safety really sold him to me. I think that he's actually going to be a good person in the group.
Yeah, you know what? That actually counted against him for me.
Uh-oh.
Because I liked the fact that Noah was a little bit morally ambiguous. Like, he started out, you think you know what you're getting. Oh, he's a nice kid, you know?
And he's got a gun pointed at Daryl and Carol, right?
That's the point, right? Mm-hmm. And then he becomes a little bit more interesting. He's got this strong sense of self-preservation. It seems a little bit, not out of character, but it developed his character. He can be mean when he needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it felt to me that in that last episode, when he offered to give himself up for the group, that was really a way for the scriptwriters to have him atone for being mean to Daryl and Carol. Carol later.
And it set Beth's death up too, really, didn't it?
Do you know what I mean? Just so that he can now proceed to be like a genuine nice guy member of the group. I liked it when it was a little bit more ambiguous. I would like it to, the second half of the season to continue with there being a little bit of perhaps tension between Carol, Daryl and Noah. Because even though Noah kind of proved himself to be a good guy at the end there, if I was Daryl, I'm intensely upset about Beth's death. I would still have kind of negative feelings towards Noah or anyone who was involved in the hospital.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, that would make sense. And I think that you might see that tension. Is Carol even going to stay with the group going forward? I guess we'll talk about this in our series preview.
Well, there's a question, isn't there? Because, I mean, Carol wasn't part of the group.
And she was trying to leave, right?
She came back only because she felt that there was some sort of emergency she had to get involved with. And yeah, as you said, she had that car set aside and it looked like she was trying to leave.
Well, we'll get to her later. In fact, we'll get to her in about a month. Then we have some other characters that we probably, well, we've got one in Officer Dawn Lerner, who was the head of the cops at the Grady Memorial, who we definitely will not see again because she was killed by Daryl pretty clearly. Mm-hmm. The whole shot to the middle of the forehead being quite an effective way of dispatching.
That's pretty conclusive.
We did have Dr. Steven Edwards, played by Eric Jensen, who was an interesting, again, conflicted character. But we probably won't see him again because I think they're moving past Grady at this point.
Yeah,
there's no guarantees. I mean, we could open up in episode 9 and down comes Dr. Edwards out of the hospital saying, take me with you, right? We don't know.
So the only reason that Edwards was in there was to have someone who kind of tricked Beth.
He's a Judas character. He appears to be on your side, but in fact, he's utilizing what he has, the tools he has available to him to play both sides.
Right.
That's why he actually has that painting in his room, which we discussed at length when we were looking at that episode 4.
Oh, the Caravaggio?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, with the chiaroscuro, the lightness in the dark.
Exactly. Beautiful, yeah. Beautiful. And then we had Joan, who was the Keisha Castle Hughes character. I only bring her up because, again, she was... just an interesting person to have, and she kind of opened Beth's eyes to what the hospital is really about.
Yeah, and she was important because she was a victim who turned the tables.
Oh, she set herself up beautifully. She went and committed suicide in such a way that she would be there to kill Dawn.
Do you know, one unfortunate thing about it is Beth is supposed to be seen as that character, the victim figure who, you know, finds some strength and manages to turn the tables. But Joan's character actually did a far better job of it. Like, her sacrifice was more complete. It was more beautiful, you know, like a rising from the dead to tear out the throat of your rapist.
Oh yeah,
like
yeah.
That's a really good bit of justice.
It was poetic.
Beth's ending was just dumb.
it was unnecessary.
Do you know what I mean? Why would you do that?
It made no sense.
I had very little sympathy for Beth anyway. I was just kind of mad at her for putting everyone else in jeopardy at the end.
Well, yeah, I mean, that could have turned into, you know, like that scene we were talking about a few different shootout scenes where everything goes to shit.
Yeah, it could have been way worse.
It could have been like that, and it didn't, because of the cool-headed response of that one cop.
Yeah.
Who they had as a hostage for a while. Who else did we have? We had Morgan, the return of Morgan. Interestingly, we saw him in the stinger in episode 1.
Yeah.
And then we didn't see him again until the stinger in episode 8. So he bookended the season, the half season.
I was just thinking, when I'm thinking about Morgan, he's a character who's kind of a loose end, someone we let go of earlier on. Are there any other loose end characters who left the main storyline, but we're not sure what happened to them?
There was a family in season 1. I can't remember their name. They were a young Hispanic family with 2 kids, I believe. And they took off. They took off in the first season. There were the Vatos in Atlanta.
Yeah.
They would seem like an interesting group with potential.
They were. We didn't really get to know them too much, though.
Although I like the fact that they had the tough guy kind of, you know, facade, and then they were actually just helping a bunch of people at a seniors home, which was pretty cool. They could potentially be there in the future. Although you got to think that if the cops are kind of patrolling Atlanta, then they would have at least had some contact with the Vatos at some point.
You think so? Yeah.
Other than that,
I was trying to think, were there anyone else from Herschel's farm? But no, I just realized the only member of the Green family who's still alive
is Maggie.
Is Maggie.
Yeah, that's right.
She's all on her own.
Yeah, she's the last one.
So, we're going to move on now to talk about character arcs and kind of major changes in some of the familiar characters in the show.
Of the familiar ones, Rick, I think, he had the biggest changes.
I mean, Rick did a lot of action in this season so far, but he hasn't done a lot in terms of interaction and character development with other people. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think so. He wasn't the motive force for a lot of the season. You had Carol being the motive force. You had Gareth being the motive force. You had Abraham being the motive force, Daryl and Carol being the motive force, and Rick's kind of been following along for all these different things that are happening. But at the same time, Rick is changing again. Now we had surprised sick Rick, we had taking charge Rick, we had farmer Rick, Then we had Kick-Ass Rick come back, but in between we had Crazy Hallucinating Rick.
Yeah.
But now we've got the One Strike and You're Out Rick. Like, he's just not willing to put up with any shit whatsoever. And we saw this beautifully in the last episode. It was essentialized down to two moments. The moment when he shoots Lamson, and then he just says to him, shut up. Harsh, hard.
It works in two ways. In one sense, he's like the Samuel L. Jackson character from Pulp Fiction, you know? Bringing down vengeance. But he's also kind of, it's not just righteousness, you know?
No.
It was that immense righteousness and the ruthlessness that comes with it. Sure, now and again, you're going to have to kill someone. It's distasteful, but you need to live by a code. He understands that and he lives by it. But he's becoming vindictive.
When they take out the termites?
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Do you know? I mean, that's not the same thing anymore. I mean, that's more than an execution. That's a cathartic execution.
It wasn't just, and that was perhaps the first moment of agency he really had this season, because he was the leader, and following him were Michonne, Sasha, and Abraham as they absolutely mutilated each of their victims.
You've got Abraham, who we know can do that kind of thing anyway. That's in him. You've got Rick. This is a new part of his personality. You've got Sasha, who has good reason to be furious.
Anger over Bob's death, yeah.
Yeah, so the only confusing member of that bloodbath, I guess, would be Michonne.
But she's the lieutenant, right? Yeah. In a lot of ways, she's Rick's lieutenant. And she's
just carrying out orders. She's like Daryl. She's very much like Daryl.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, if you were ever to get into a larger group of people with these survivors as kind of the leaders, you would see Rick at the head with Michonne on his right hand and Daryl on his left, or vice versa. You know, they would be the ones carrying out the orders, you'd think.
Right.
Although we did have Daryl stand up to Rick in this season, when Tyrese had the idea of doing the exchange as opposed to going in and shooting everybody.
Yeah.
Which was interesting, but it was Daryl as a voice of reason.
We're not sure if it marks kind of a change in Daryl's character from someone who wants to stand up for Rick or play a bigger part in making decisions, or whether it was just born out of the motivation to protect Beth.
Yeah, yeah. I think, to be honest, Beth and Carol both, because those are the two women he loves, right?
Yeah.
Now, whether he loves them as mothers, sisters, lovers, who knows? He loves them. We know that.
So with Rick's character arc, I mean, he's moved in a certain direction towards feral, towards righteous now.
Yeah, you were mentioning his body language earlier in the season. You were talking about how he hunches forward and, yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. He's very, very animalic. It's an interesting question, like, where can he go from here? He's obviously headed for some kind of trouble. They wouldn't be moving in this direction if he wasn't. In my opinion. Personally, I think he is the character. I mean, this is all quite often the case, but I think he is the character to watch in the second half of the season.
And it is Rick's show, really, ultimately, right?
Pretty much. So we should probably move on to other characters who've shown a bit of development or, you know, major changes in their character.
Abraham, I wouldn't say we had a lot of development so much as we just had reveal. We knew he was a barely contained rage machine.
Mm-hmm.
The very first episode, we saw him when he was using the butt of his gun to take out a zombie that was attacking the door of his truck. He just had this big grin on his face.
In a joyful glee.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. He loved it.
But we see him also, you know, taking a rather grim, more grim satisfaction in the flashbacks of him defending his family.
That's true. And then when he feels betrayed, the way he takes Eugene down.
Now that part, I think that was kind of understandable. I know we've already said that Abraham probably has a little bit more to thank Eugene for than he would admit. But, you know, Eugene has really betrayed him at that point. It kind of makes sense that he'd want to punch seven bells out of him.
People have died because of this.
Yeah. I didn't see that as the mark of a psychopath. But what preceded it and what came after it, you know, the way that he treated Rosita and the way he kind of squared up to Maggie, it showed that he's definitely got, I guess, what Viserys in the Game of Thrones would call a dragon.
Yeah.
That you don't want to wake, you know?
No, he's definitely fighting demons inside.
Mm-hmm.
And he is able to control. I mean, like when he faces off against first Rosita and then Maggie, he doesn't hit Rosita. He doesn't try to force Maggie's hand. He kneels back down again, but he's barely under control.
Yeah.
Now we see him change over the next episode and a half, where by the end of it, he's even looking at Eugene with some sort of concern on his face. He's realized perhaps that, you know, he reacted in the moment. He reacted fairly for what happened to him in that world, but he regrets having hurt Eugene so badly.
In a way, right, it's kind of incredible that more didn't happen when he and Rick squared off, you know, when Abraham decided that he wanted to leave the church.
Oh, I know. That was Glenn the diplomat, right?
Yeah, it's kind of incredible that didn't end up much worse than they did.
True.
Because both of these guys are able to lose it, you know, and that seemed like a situation where they might.
I agree, and they're both alpha males, right? Although Abraham is trained to follow. He's a non-commissioned officer, he's a sergeant, so he's meant to take charge.
Yeah.
He's used to taking charge, but he's also used to taking orders from people he perceives as being his superiors.
Right. Do you know what? That's really interesting, because when he split off from the group and he became, you know, de facto the leader, quickly descended into chaos, right? Like, all of his decisions were based around his kind of aggressiveness and his desire to move onwards. And very quickly, the members of his group, Tara, Glenn, were questioning his authority. They were saying, you know, is this really what you want us to be doing, driving through this field with this fire truck, etc., you know? Yeah, if I had to liken Abraham to a character, it would be Animal Mother from Full Metal Jacket.
That'll do.
All right, so the next character who's kind of interesting in that huge switch, Eugene.
The pedant, the scientist, the savior of mankind, turns out to be a great big fake.
He's a big fraud.
He's a fraud.
He's a big nobody.
He's a lovable fraud. You see the way he was running from... There's a flashback with Abraham. Abraham's about to kill himself. And along comes Eugene with his arms flapping like a poor little T-Rex.
Yeah.
And he's moving at about 2 miles an hour with like this shuffling zombie outrunning him. Going, help me! Help me!
Imagine how annoyed he must feel though. Because like he... You know, that parking lot was huge. He was like, oh look, there's a guy over there. Maybe he could help me. And he's run all the way across there. And he's like, don't shoot yourself.
Come and help me first.
This is the worst possible timing. For me, that is a love scene.
Yeah.
It's a love scene. It's two characters running towards each other. They have what economists would call a mutual coincidence of wants. Like, each one completes the other. They're just like, oh, you have a mission. You have an active body and the ability to use it, you know? It's completely perfect.
And the way they just walked off together into the proverbial sunset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. So Eugene's going to be one to watch because we've no idea what he's like. Even post having the crap kicked out of him by Abraham, he's been fairly catatonic in the back of the fire truck.
Exactly. So on then we have to Sasha.
Yeah. Now, in our show notes, our beautifully produced show notes that you produced this week, you've written Avenging Angel.
Yes.
In what sense is Sasha an Avenging Angel?
I see her as an Avenging Angel because she... before she fell in love with Bob, was kind of a non-entity to some degree in the show. But with Bob's death, she suddenly discovers her skill as a sniper. Uh-huh. She suddenly discovers her desire to wreak death and destruction upon those who oppose her. She's part of the slaughter of the termites. When she takes out that walker, when Rick is facing down with the two cops, when they're starting to negotiate, that's a damn good shot.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't know that she's had any training as a shooter before, right?
No. So, the last sharpshooter was Angie, right? She was like a preternatural.
Yeah, except when she shot Daryl, which was kind of a bit of a mistake. But, sorry about that.
Daryl shot himself?
Oh, God.
He shot himself with a crossbow.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. When Andrea shot Daryl, fortunately, she wasn't such a good sharpshooter that time.
No. So Sasha's a little bit more reliable in that regard. Where is her? So her dedication to Bob and the tragedy of his death has what explained some of her actions so far in the show. Where does that leave her now, though? Like, what is her main motivation? Is she just pissed off at the world?
Well, no, I think she's pissed off at the world. She's pissed off at herself, though. She's pissed off that she wasn't the one who put the knife into Bob's temple. And yet
But where does that leave her in terms of motivation going forward?
I think it gives her a certain loyalty because the group supported her and showed love for Bob, which gave her that sense of belonging. I think she's got more of a sense of family now than she had before.
Right.
I think she's probably as loyal in her own way as Daryl or Michonne, to be honest, at this point, and I think she's going to be as valuable.
She seems like another lieutenant, though, right? She's joining Michonne and Daryl as kind of...
She's more a corporal, but she'll work her way up.
I'm just wondering how we're going to be able to distinguish those characters really now, because neither Daryl or Michonne or Sasha have any particular interests other than staying alive, any particular demons driving them. I'm just wondering, you know...
You've got tropes. I mean, you've got, in a sense, you've got Michonne's the samurai, right?
They're all but that's the thing. It's three weapons specialists, right? Who are pretty loyal and, you know, good at getting shit done.
That's true, but they also approach things differently. Like, Sasha'll be the death from above. You know, she's the one from a distance. Daryl's the scout. Michonne is not just the samurai, but also the ninja. You remember that episode when Merle and a couple of the boys from Woodbury go out to find Michonne and she's just disappearing into the trees?
Yeah.
Yeah, so she's got that aspect too. I don't know. They are similar and yet somehow different.
Yeah.
And I don't yet know how much they're different. That's true. They're going to have to find ways of differentiating those characters, or they're going to end up offing one of them probably in the next half season.
We might as well do this now. If you had to guess the next character who's going to buy it in the group, who would you pick?
Tyrese.
Yeah, my money's on Tyrese or Sasha all the way.
I'm surprised he's still alive, actually. They're peripheral enough still to the main core of the group, even though they've been around for 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
They still feel somewhat on the periphery. And Tyrese has been a much less useful character in the show than he is in the comic, frankly. It's an interesting change. He's a very different person in the comic book.
There's a good case to be made for Rosita as well.
She's the actress Christian Serratos. She was on Talking Dead, I think, after episode 7. And it was really interesting to hear her talking because I guess this is probably part of the ego that an actor or an actress has to have. But she was basically saying that she thought Rosita was one of the most important characters in the show. And I was like, I'm listening going,
really?
My dear actor.
You mean this show?
Yeah, yes, exactly. And I think Christian Serratos, she's a wonderfully well-spoken person. She seems like she's really on the ball. She knows her stuff. She loves her character. And of course she loves her character, right? It's a great show. You're on the number one show on TV. You want to stay on that number one show. But I think she's misreading herself if she thinks she's that important, to be
perfectly
honest.
She's certainly not that important to the audience, I don't think. She's played quite an important role in this season so far.
But you she's know, really
her interactions
only had,
with Abraham have been important.
But how many actual lines has she had total? I mean, she's been in all of about six episodes, parts of six episodes, and I think she's probably had less than 30 lines total.
Yeah, she's probably only had about three scenes when she's one of the key characters.
Exactly. The last one we were going to mention is the change that we see in Father Gabriel from when we first meet him screaming on the rock to carrying a machete.
Yeah, so his transformation, I guess, is probably the most dramatic, even though it's felt like he's hardly changed at all in some ways.
It's because of his starting point, which was literally being holed up for 2 years, ignoring the world outside.
Yeah.
And then having to come to terms with it in a very short period of time, being forced by Rick and the group, and also by, as we see in episode 8, the invasion of the church eventually, right?
Yeah, right. So he's managed to face his own demons, he's managed to atone, he's managed to learn to trust people again. An awful lot's happened to Father Gabriel.
I think that for him, one of the key moments is when he goes to the school and he sees Bob's maggot ridden leg, and he realizes that the world is as bad as Rick and the gang have been telling him. He realizes that as much as he was trying with his bleeding fingernails to scrape the blood off of the floorboards in his church from the slaughter, that what they did to those termites was fully justified.
Mm-hmm.
And this has changed the way he perceives them, but also himself. Yeah, and I think he's going to become a useful character moving forward.
The characters who have a little bit of cowardice about them, you know, who freak out, who get squeamish, like him and Eugene, and, you know, to an extent, Tara. You know, basically people who treat the apocalypse with something other than complete competence. You know, they're amusing. They're a bit of light relief. And
can I be politically incorrect with Tara for a second?
Yes.
Maybe I shouldn't go down this path. There's a word that we used to use when I was a kid, which was very derogatory. And I would never use it nowadays because I worked in group homes with developmentally disabled adults for a number of years.
Now, this has sounded like one of those stories that begins with, hey, I'm not racist, but
my Uncle Graham.
Yeah.
Love him to bits. And Uncle Graham, if you're listening, you're an awesome guy. But he when he was younger, he used to like fall. He used to walk into things. He one time, he had this hamster and he was running around the house with it. Dropped it in front of him and he stomped on it.
Jesus Christ.
He came running back to his mom and dad. There's guts out both ends of the freaking hamster. He's like, the mean kid next door stepped on my hamster. But turns out, of course, he squished it himself because he was just clumsy.
Mm.
Shook a bottle of ketchup. The lid was loose. Got ketchup all over the room and his clothes. You know, like just constantly having things like that happen. Frankly. And so she's the village idiot. She's the village idiot.
It's not that she's just an idiot. She seems to just be a little bit detached.
Like, and she's simple and fun. And she's like, I found a yo-yo. Like, there is no character development in Tara. She gets excited over finding a mucky yo-yo in, like, a zombie's poxy-ridden body. You know, that's, look what I found. We think she's found, you know, the cure. She's so excited. But she's kind of like that simple uncle. Yeah,
yeah, she's really lovable and goofy.
I like Tara. I really do. But she frustrates me at times, too.
But she's lovely. Honestly, one of my favorite characters. Oh, I hope nothing ever happens to her.
She's fun.
Yeah, if she was the last character standing, I'd be happy.
She could be the one. She's got a more cunning plan than Eugene.
All right, so what we're going to do now is Is that theme tune to something? Is that Jeopardy? Or
that's Jeopardy, yeah.
I have prepared a quiz for Steve. Listeners might have noticed that we have different roles on this podcast. Steve's role involves knowing things. Not really sure what mine involves.
I pretend to know things. Hey, I got my student evaluations back this week.
Oh, you did?
And one of them said, nothing, terrible teacher.
Really?
So, yeah. Beautiful. All the rest were really positive.
You always get at least one or two that are just horrendous. Steve and I are both college instructors. We both teach undergraduate courses.
I teach English Lit and Dan teaches sociology and crim.
Yeah.
I got told I have a good sense of hummus by one of my students. I'm pretty sure he meant something else.
No, he didn't. That was a very wry comment.
I
applaud that student.
I was quite pleased. Okay, so you have a quiz. You want to ask me some questions?
Yeah, I have. You just finished marking all of your end of semester exams. So I have an exam for you, Steve.
Mm.
I've got 20 questions test your knowledge of the first half of season 5.
Caveat, this may get changed to 10 depending on my answers.
It might. And I've decided, and here is my marking rubric, okay? If you get less than 15 out of 20, you have to cut off and eat your own leg.
Oh, God.
If you get between 15 and 19 correct, we get to change the name of the podcast to the Dan and Steve podcast.
Okay.
So if you get 20 out of 20, that's the only good result for you, Steve.
There's really no benefit to me to take this quiz whatsoever. I think my phone's suddenly dying. I'm not sure, but conveniently, right before the quiz.
But okay. If you get 20 out of 20, I will bring you a vintage ale for Christmas.
Ooh, lovely.
One that you've never had before.
I would love to get it. I'd love a nice ale. All right. Cheers, mate.
All right. So there's going to be 4 rounds. Okay. The first round is a short answer round. Round 2 is multiple choice. Round 3 is a dialogue quiz. And finally, the hardcore challenge questions for round 4.
Oh my God.
And there's a bonus question as well, just in case you're slipping behind. I might give you that one.
Appreciate that.
All right. So you ready to go?
Yes.
Yeah, you feel strong?
I was born ready.
Okay, man.
My body is willing.
Round 1, short answer questions. Number 1, this is a gimme. What color was the handle of the machete that Rick used to kill Gareth?
Red.
Nice.
And it continued to be red after he used it to kill it.
Number 2, the soundtrack has been particularly excellent for season 5. Who is responsible for it?
Bear McCreary.
Hey.
It's 2 for 2.
He gets a lot of love.
I'm getting beer.
There are 2 or characters bear. Who share the same first name.
I'm sorry. What was that again?
There are 2 characters who share the same first name. Give their full names.
Bob Stuckey and Bob Lamson.
Listen to you. Number 4. Now this one's going to cause you a bit of trouble.
Oh, God.
Which hand does Abraham punch Eugene with, and how many times does he punch him?
I believe he's a southpaw.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's 3 times.
It is 3 times.
Yeah.
Yeah, left-handed and 3 times.
Yeah.
And the final question of the short answer round is, what color is the fletching on Daryl's crossbow bolts?
Oh, that's good, because I think they're green, but I'm probably wrong. Green or white, and they're neither, are they? What are they?
What's your final answer, Steve?
Green.
They are green. They're actually green and white, but I was going to accept green, because green's the predominant color.
Oh, really? Okay, well, there you go. I guess I did know that.
And apparently they used to be red and white, but he changed brand halfway through.
Strange. Yeah. How did I know that, Dan?
I don't know.
How the hell did I know that?
The reason they were green was because there was that one that got stuck in the zombie's throat.
Yes, I remember that image. Yeah, I've got that in my head still.
Yeah, and consumed, I think it was. Okay, round 2, multiple choice. So you have to wait for the entire question to be asked before you give your answer.
See.
So number 6, Carol sleeps in the offices of a law firm. What was the law for? What was the law firm called? All right, A, Saul Goodman and Associates. Listeners of Breaking Bad might recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
B, the Brea Law Firm. C, the Whalen Law Firm.
I think it's Whalen, wasn't it?
It was Whalen.
Okay, yeah.
Great guess.
Okay, thanks. I had a 1 in 3 chance.
Okay. Number 7, the lollipop that Gorman put into Beth's mouth was A, red, B, purple with a throbbing vein, C, green.
It was green.
It was green.
But it should have been red. It would have been more appropriate. Purple with a throbbing vein might have been a little bit too symbolic.
Yeah, my researchers wrote that question. Number 8. When Dr. Edwards tricked Beth into giving a patient the wrong medicine, what was the wrong medicine? Was it A, clonazepam, B, clozapine, or C, clotted cream?
clozapine.
Clozapine is the correct answer.
Yep.
Okay, number 9. In episode
clonazepam, by the way, is an antipsychotic.
Which one is? So
it's clonazepam is an antipsychotic.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah.
Number 9. In episode 2, Strangers, Michonne kills a zombie with which kitchen item? A, a rolling pin. B, an egg beater. Or C, a slap chop.
Ew. Slap chop. I wish it were a slap chop. It was an egg beater. It was pretty good, actually.
Finally, number 10. In episode 5, Self-Help, Tara suggests that the group find some bicycles. Why? A. Bikes never run out of gas. B. Bikes are not flammable. C. Bikes are super awesome fun.
Well, being Tara... It's got to be C, but it's, I know, it's, they're not flammable. That's not true. They are flammable. I believe they don't ever run out of gas.
Incorrect, Steve.
Oh, fuck. Well, was it awesome fun?
They don't burn.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Oh, my God. Tara, you're just a jerk.
Why did you go with the answer that made sense, Steve?
Oh, that's just Tara. See, I should have gone with super awesome fun.
You should have known. This is because you called her names earlier.
Oh, that's true.
So you're one down, Steve. That means you might actually need the bonus.
I don't get the beer. Okay.
No. Well, no, there's a bonus question later, though.
Okay. Well, I'm 90%. I'm pretty good.
You're pretty good. So you've only got one wrong. You're 9 out of 10. So round 3, we're moving on to the dialogue quiz now. A set of questions based around utterances. Number 11. Which character describes Eugene's hair as a Tennessee top hat?
Abraham.
Is that your final answer?
Oh, fuck. Was it Rosita? No, or Maggie?
Give this some thought, Steve.
Okay, it's got to be Glenn or Maggie or Rosita.
Give this some thought, or Abraham. Steve.
Oh, okay. It's
which character describes Eugene's hair as a Tennessee top hat?
Eugene?
Yes.
Oh, that's right. He does. He calls it that. Who calls it a Kentucky waterfall?
I'm not sure.
Yay. Okay. Thank you for giving me an option there.
Number 12. Mm. Who says, the short bus ain't going nowhere. Bring you back some baked beans.
The short bus ain't going nowhere.
Oh, it's more like this. The short bus ain't going nowhere. I'll bring you back some baked beans.
Well, that sounds like Abraham, the way you said it there. But
Abraham's the one who wants
to take the short bus. But it's Rick, because Rick doesn't want Abraham to take the bus. And this is their confrontation in the church.
It's not Rick.
It's not Rick?
No, it's Daryl.
Oh, son of a bitch.
Yeah.
You see, your Daryl impression sounds like Rick, dude.
Yeah, so that's my fault, actually. I should probably take responsibility for that one.
I think you should.
Yeah. So we'll still say that you're 11 for 12. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. All right, complete...
I'm falling apart here, man.
Complete the following line.
Even though the things that we do, they were worth it.
Yes, they were.
Okay, yeah.
Michonne in episode 7 cross.
That was the worst line of the entire 8 episodes, possibly the whole series so far.
Okay, question number 14. Who says, we ain't ashes?
Oh, can you give me the episode?
Yeah, episode 6, Consumed. So that should narrow it down to 2.
We eat ashes. That's Daryl.
Mm-hmm.
That's Daryl, yeah.
That's right. Number 15. Who says, stumbling around in 3 feet of slime for some peas and carrots, that's living.
that's a great line. Can you give me the episode on that one?
Yeah, episode 2, Strangers.
Stumbling around in 3 feet of slime for peas and carrots, that's living. Okay, so this is after they've gone into the basement where the food is.
Mm-hmm.
Who was in there? And it's definitely not Father Gabriel saying that.
It's definitely not Father Gabriel.
That's not something Michonne would say.
Isn't it?
So, it definitely no. Oh, God. Look, she just killed a guy with an egg beater.
She did?
Yeah. That sounds like it could be a Michonne quip. We'll go with her.
It's Michonne.
Okay, there we go. Yeah.
So now, okay. Steve, you're going to be excited by this. Round 4, these are the difficult questions.
Well, but okay, go ahead.
No, you're good. You're, what are you? I think you're 14 for 15, aren't you?
Well, with some generosity, yes.
Yeah. No, this is legit.
Okay.
All right. Number 16, Rick and Gareth uttered identical lines this season. What was the line?
Oh, jeez. Shut up?
Not shut up.
Can you give me a hint?
Yeah, the lines were... each directed to different characters who have the same name.
Okay, so when... Well, I don't think Rick was telling Bob Lamson how good he tasted.
No. Nope. Although, who knows?
Well, we didn't see what happened after he shot him, did we? it's got to be something along the lines of, you know, we do what we have to, something like that. Or you tried to run. You tried to run.
Well, you know,
you should have stopped.
You should have stopped. Yeah,
you should have stopped.
But what was Bob Lamson asking Rick to do?
He was asking Rick to help him.
To take him.
Take me to the hospital.
Yeah, but you can't.
You can't go back.
You can't.
You can't.
You can't go back, Bob. You were going to say, right?
Bob,
you
can't go back.
That's right.
You can't go back, Bob.
That's it, Steve.
You can't. Yes.
That's
apparently
it.
I got this one right.
Steve, the knowledge Zillard.
That and that he tasted much better than they expected.
Yes. Number 17.
I'm wrong.
With a due sense of exhaustion and dread, what three items does Morgan place on the altar in episode 8?
Oh, that's a good question. He places a bullet. He places a lucky rabbit's foot. It was edible.
Yeah.
It was a chocolate bar.
Yeah, it was a little chocolate bar.
That's right.
Some kind of snack. Nice one, Steve. You said it was a ding-dong. It's not a ding-dong. It's something else, but it's something along those lines.
It was like one of those chocolate cakes. Hostess cake or something. Hostess cock. I'm always on about the cock. I don't know what this is.
All right. Question 18. In episode 7 of the podcast, podcast.
That's not about the show.
It is.
Well, it was, yeah.
Steve refers to Edwards and Beth by the wrong names. What names does Steve give to Edwards and Beth?
Oh, God. Okay, so I think that for Edwards, I called him like, oh, Jesus. Not Dean, Dave, Dr. Edwards. Oh, you know, you can be the first letter.
was it a D?
It was a D. Daniels, Dr. Daniels.
Daniels, yeah. Me.
That's right.
And with Beth?
Beth, can you give me the first letter?
Well, the name is very similar to her regular name, except you changed her gender.
Ben.
Ben. That's it, Steve. Ben.
I'm right again.
You can't be stopped.
I cannot be. I'm unstoppable. Okay. Why did I call her Ben? Jeez.
All right, number 19.
Dr. Daniels.
What did Abraham's wife write in her note that she left for Abraham?
Don't try to follow us.
Jeez, man, that's awesome. Why couldn't you do this for the last 25
questions? I don't know. That's because it's something I'm familiar to seeing when my wife leaves me notes in the morning.
Okay, so by my reckoning, you're 18 for 19 right now.
I like your reckoning, yes.
Question 20. Who, according to Eugene, is the director of the Human Genome Project?
Oh, gosh. And he likes mullets. He thought his mullet was quite good.
Uh-huh.
Darn it. I did write that one down on my notes, but I'm not going to refer to my notes because you're going to give me a hint, aren't you?
Well, his name begins with an initial.
Yes, it's T.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's T.
And his second name is a popular brand of sports footwear.
Nike. Reebok.
He's such a dick.
Adidas.
T. Gola. T. Le Coq Sportif.
Yes. You're on about the cock now. Okay, so T. crap.
T. And his last name is the same. It's half the surname of the guy who wrote American Psycho.
No, that's not Chuck Palahniuk. No, that's not helping me. I know I've got American Psycho on my. Wait a second. I'm going to turn around and look at my bookshelf. Okay, Bret Easton Ellis. So Ellis would be the...
So we have T and we have Ellis.
Yeah.
All we need to do is insert in between those two.
What's the first letter of the first name? I need this. I need... You must.
It's a B.
I've got some Dalmore here that I'll share with you if you'll remember.
It's a B. T.B. Ellis.
T.B. Is it T.B. Ellis? T. Brooks Ellis.
It's T. Brooks Ellis.
Yeah, I remember now. I suddenly remembered. It suddenly came to me. I don't know how. It's this ability I have to suddenly recall shit.
No, it's true. I jumped in and gave you clues too soon. I'll take responsibility for that.
Well, thank you. I mean, you bastard.
So you have a bonus question.
Okay.
I feel sad to give you this bonus question now because it's really, really difficult.
Okay. I'm crying here.
But you might know it because you know this kind of thing, Steve.
Okay.
All right. Only one director directed two episodes in the first half of this season.
Oh.
You can either tell me who he was or which two episodes he directed.
It was Ernest R. Dickerson, right?
It was Ernest R. Dickerson. Yeah, that's correct. Which two episodes? Like, so that,
well, he did Coda. I know he did Coda. He did the last one, right?
He definitely did Coda, yeah.
And I'm pretty sure he did one of the earlier ones, too.
He did.
I'm going to get Slab Tongue, but I'm probably wrong on that.
Oh, so close. Self-help.
Self-help. Okay. Oh, well, that's not bad.
So I'm going to give you...
a half point?
I'm going to give you half a point there.
So you can round me up. So you end, as we do, we Steve, round up.
You end on 18 and a half, which rounds up to 19. Oh, just one
shy. I missed the beer.
Just one shy of a vintage.
Was it self-help, Dan? Was it self-help? Was that the other one?
It was self-help, yeah.
Well, there you go. I go.
You've been, Steve, you've been a fantastic contender.
Well, thank you so much. I came so close.
We're going to give you the vintage ale.
Oh, you're
you can keep the name of the podcast with your name before mine.
And that I should just mention this. The only reason my name is at the front of the podcast is because that was the available domain name. The Dan and Steve show was not available. And that's what I told Dan, and I'm sticking to it. Okay, so thanks for that awesome quiz. I had fun with that. That was pretty bad.
No, that was actually incredible. To be honest, if you'd have put me through 20 random questions like that, I probably would have got about 7 or 8.
I was surprised at the specificity of your questions. I give quizzes to my students. They would kill me if I was that specific.
Yeah.
Maybe we should move on to the last couple of things we want to talk about before we finish up this podcast. Okay, so we got problems, issues,
and
continuity.
We've spent the last section of the podcast revealing Steve's problems. Now,
what? My knowledge. My
we're now going to move on to talk about some of our bugbears from the first half of the season so far.
Maggie
has been an issue. Yeah. This is one that everyone's kind of whining on about on the internet, is the fact that she's had very little concern for Beth whatsoever. But it can't be ignored.
The only time she's even mentioned Beth was in the very first episode when the group is reunited outside and Daryl mentions to her that he saw Beth getting taken in a car. Now, why he didn't say this to her in the train car earlier, I don't know. But in any case, she doesn't really respond to that. And then as soon as Glenn's like, hey, let's go with Abraham and Eugene so that they can... You know, we can stop the fight between Rick and Abraham. She's like, yeah, okay, yes, I'll go with you. No question. Forget about Beth. She'll be fine. Or she's already dead, or who knows what she's thinking, because she never, ever expresses it. You know, granted, Maggie has a grand total of about 6 lines in the whole season up until, like, self-help.
Yeah, she has... Yeah, in fact, the only sustained dialogue that Maggie has at all is really with Abraham.
Yeah, she's... And this is obviously a problem when you've got pretty much, 15 or 18 main characters, right?
They give her a few good lines dotted around, come to think of it. She's the one who says the 4 walls and a roof from the episode of the same name, yeah.
Exactly, to Father Gabriel.
But other than that, very little.
What's the next one?
Yeah, Grady Memorial.
How do they maintain that lifestyle?
It's a weird one, isn't it?
I think that Officer Lerner has her recumbent bicycle hooked up to some sort of a generator. I'm pretty sure.
It would make sense.
Yeah. They have power. They have food. Mm-hmm. The medical supplies, you can argue that was there in the hospital. Where are they getting the food from? Where's the power coming from? We don't hear a generator.
They're living a pretty lavish lifestyle. I mean, I remember that scene in the first episode, Slab Town, when you've got Gorman walking around what looks like a pretty well-stocked cafeteria.
True.
So they're certainly not short of food. And car batteries, yeah, fair enough. I mean, I guess if they've got a lot of gas that they can get hold of, they can keep recharging those batteries, can't they?
But, okay, here's the question. You what do you use to recharge? Diesel generators, right? What do diesel generators do besides make sound? I mean, sorry. I answered my own question.
They make power.
Yes. Okay. Let's go back.
Yeah.
What do they do besides making power? Yeah, they make a lot of noise. So it's going to.
But they could just be recharging car batteries using actual cars.
That's true. They do have a bunch of those. They could even be using solar power. We see some stuff up on the roof, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's hard to say, but the amount of power that they seem to use is pretty substantial. They've got.
I think they were hinting at the idea that they were farming up there on the roof, but it seemed like a pretty limited operation.
Well, the number of people, the indication to me seemed to be that there was probably about 40 or 50 people living in the hospital.
Yeah.
Although we never see all of them at one time, there's certainly indications there's a lot of people that are living on the periphery that are there.
They've got guinea pigs though, right?
They do. And they're very
Those
tasty.
Those things are pretty easy
they're
to take care of.
They're very tasty, apparently. Oh, this is a Peruvian delicacy. Or not even a delicacy, it's a main meal in some countries in South America.
Yeah.
I don't have any guinea pig recipes offhand, but I hear that they're quite good. I actually had a Peruvian student this semester. I should have asked him as a relevant question to the episode. But
I feel like they'd be the same as rabbit somehow.
Probably would. Yeah, they're a rodent. Okay, so there were problems with Grady Memorial, and again, a lot of these problems that we're talking about right now, we were willing to kind of overlook them because the overall quality of the show was quite high. But we did have the miracle van. As I called it, I think, in our show notes, the miracle van and the highly improbable landing. They fall off of a overpass.
It was a huge, not huge, but it was a bit of a shark jump moment, really, wasn't it?
It's not jumping the shark, though.
It's not the show jumping the shark, but you're still flipping the van. Come on.
Yeah, it flips all the way around and lands on its wheels, which just doesn't make, like, physics.
Like, who came up with that idea? And why didn't someone say no? That's fucking stupid.
Yeah.
We must better do something else. Can't they just, you know, awkwardly fall off? Why, you know, we're not gaining anything from having the thing flip over other than make ourselves look like amateurs.
No, because as anybody with any sense of physics knows, you have a front end heavy object like that van go over front end first, it's going to just go straight down, nose into the ground.
Yeah, and it's silly. It was a bad decision. Mm-hmm. Why do it, you know?
Yeah, because I think they just got a bit giddy. Cool. I think they thought it looked cool.
Maybe it made more sense on paper or whatever.
But. Apparently, they used three vans for the shot as well.
Yeah, they did. I was reading about it. I mean, honestly, I think quite often this must be the way it is. They get an idea for something, you put everything in place, you hire a crew, you set things up. You probably realize it's not going to work, but by that point, everyone's been paid. You've got to have the footage. No one wants to turn around and say, all right, we screwed it up, let's do something else. You just got to make the most of it.
I get the idea that this is probably how politicians work too. They get, you know, they start out making some pretty good choices. They get, you know, they win an election. They're doing all right. Then they get surrounded by all these yes men. And they start saying, no, that's a great idea. Yeah, no, you're amazing. Everything you do is gold, you know. And then by the end of it, you see that sometimes with long running television shows too, where they literally jump the shark, right? And they get worse and worse because they got the same showrunner. Now, Scott Gimple, overall, I think he's done a great job.
Well, the show's got better the last couple of seasons.
Oh, so. For sure. And his voice has created a unity for the show. They definitely have a vision of something going forward. Mm. But yeah, that was a shark jumping
moment. Goofy.
Yeah. And then we have your favorite.
Glenn's fishing expedition.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that whole episode, it did fall apart a little bit. There were so many weird things.
What was the name
on.
That Tara came up with for the group?
Gratom.
Gratom.
Yeah.
And she had all the bottles labeled and laid out nicely. That was awesome.
It was just nuts. It was just completely nuts. It was like the whole group had just collectively lost it.
Well, you had the standoff where Abraham almost takes out Rosita, and then Maggie tells him, you know, sit down or I'll put you down. So you could ask me that in the quiz. I would have had that.
Yeah.
And he, you know, reluctantly does. And then what does Glenn up and do? Hey, let's go looking for shit. And we'll leave Maggie alone with Abraham.
Yeah.
Which is,
I mean, it didn't make any sense in terms of the character's motivation.
I'm not saying that Maggie is not fully capable of taking care of herself, probably even more so than Glenn in some situations. Mm. But you don't leave one of your group members alone with a potential psychopath.
I guess it made sense if they were thinking we need to have a little bit of something a bit whimsical to make the darkness and horror of the final episode really hit home. You know, like have something a bit more bubbly, a bit more jovial. Fair enough.
I don't hate those moments, but it just didn't make sense in the context. But overall, when you're looking at 8 episodes of a show, to come up with those as our 4 worst kind of moments, that's...
Even season 1 and season 2, there was so much crazy stuff going on there.
Yes.
But it was a different show back then, you know. When a show from the outset has a bunch of continuity problems, you either decide to live with them or not. And usually, you know, you're like, all right, I'll live with it. And then they keep coming at that same pace, fair enough. But Walking Dead has kind of cleaned its act up recently. So it was weird to see those drop back in towards the end of the first half of the season.
Definitely, because it's moved from being a pretty light horror soap opera to being a fairly serious show that examines the human psyche.
Yeah, I mean, season 3, it dropped into this kind of pointless soap opera melodrama thing.
I blame that entirely on the governor and his excellent overacting. He was mustache-twirlingly bad at times.
Mm. So we should talk about death.
Death. Death. Death is really what the show's all about. It's the grand motif.
We need it. We demand it. There must be a constant supply of it.
And we had a number of deaths. But we had 4 that particularly stuck with us when we were talking. Right. 2 of them main characters from our group, 2 of them enemies. So we'll start with the enemies.
Let's do it.
And we'll start with Dawn.
She
dies at the hands of Daryl in the proverbial Mexican standoff.
Kind of a weird one, actually. Brave in a way, because most of the times when you get a so-called villain, or at least someone whose interests are opposed to the group dying, it is a big, you know, Yahoo moment.
With Dawn, it was like she fucked up. She reacted with her cop reactions, highly trained. She's trained to protect herself. She's trained to react to violence. Beth stabs her. she immediately pulls her gun and shoots. It's just this automatic knee-jerk reaction. And her, what does she voice? You see her lips.
She says, I didn't mean to.
I didn't mean to. And she's shaking her head like, I didn't mean to. Like, back off, slow down, calm down. But before she can get all the words out, there's a hole blossoms in her forehead as Daryl takes Carol's gun, I think.
Blast her in the face. So it's kind of nice, though, really, because, you know, like you said, with the governor, with the claimers, although it's very satisfying, it also feels a little bit formulaic, a little bit cheap.
Even with the Termians, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, Gareth, you know, he had it coming, you felt great when it happened.
Catharsis, but with Dawn, capital
you know,
K.
This is a mid-season finale, an antagonist getting killed, and it's a very human moment, and it's kind of tragic.
It's almost a train wreck kind of killing. Because it's like this inevitability of it, and it's almost something you don't necessarily want to happen. Because we don't hate Dawn, we don't like her, but she's not done anything to be killed for. But until she kills Beth, you know. Obviously.
No. So the death works as a kind of statement on the tragedy of what's happened to people in a way that many of the other deaths that have resulted from standoffs and climaxes hasn't. So although I think that the storyline was a little bit flawed and we both got some problems with it, it was at least an interesting death.
It was. But not so interesting as the second bad guy, who was actually the first bad guy to die this season, which was Gareth. So this is in Father Gabriel's church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's massive. It's a massacre.
It's huge. It came sooner than we expected. Like, we talked about this, but I expected Gareth to last a little bit longer.
Maybe even till the mid-season finale, actually. It was the right choice, too. Definitely the right choice.
It was the right choice, and it was enjoyable. In this case, all right, this was a kind of predictable death. You knew it was going to happen. You don't have a character eating people and not getting killed in a huge cathartic explosion.
No, because
right?
there's so many taboos being broken here, and they have to be addressed.
But it was messy enough and weird enough to be satisfying at the same time.
And also echoes, when you see Abraham standing over his with the butt end of his gun smashing into the guy's face, it echoes with what we see later with his flashback with the can in his hand smashing to the guy's face, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we see kind of echoes across episodes as characters are being built. And it also shows Rick's desire to simply put down that which he can't trust, that which he has no desire to live with.
But in a stylistic and in a stylistic way and relishing it.
I want to say, almost Tarantino-esque, actually, when you think about like the bloodbath at the end of The Usual Suspects. Not Usual Suspects, sorry.
Reservoir Dogs,
yeah. It's very similar in the bloodiness and that kind of almost visceral joy that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not a... And by visceral joy, I don't mean like everybody's happy. I mean like there's a certain gleefulness in the approach, but it's dark.
Yeah, no, it was ritualistic. Everyone's assigned to their own person to kill, and in every case, it's overkill. Yeah, and you've got those interesting things like Gareth getting his fingers blown off by Rick. His two fingers. I don't think we ever discussed it, did we? Before he actually kills him, he blows off his two fingers.
Right.
But there is indexed finger and his middle finger. The peace fingers, the Jesus figures. A nice little detail in there too. So yeah, so Gareth's death, although you know he really had it coming and we knew it was coming and we enjoyed it. It was at least interesting. The other two people who die are the two members of our club.
They're polar opposites, right? Because Bob gets dragged out over three episodes or two episodes, and Beth's is instant.
It is, although in a way, I guess their storylines are both dragged out.
True.
Because each one of them becomes separated from the group, taken in by another group, and then upon their return to the group is slaughtered.
I thought when you were saying taken in by another group, you meant Bob was being taken in by the hunters.
he's literally
being
ingested.
Taken in, yes. Yeah. he became part of the group. Yes, poor Bob.
It seems that if you go outside of the group, you become tainted and you cannot return.
Tainted, as in tainted meat?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes me wonder about other people, such as Carol, who have been wantaways for a while. I'm wondering what's going to happen with Carol now that she's presumably an invalid.
Or Morgan when he comes back, because he's been so far out of contact with civilization of any sort for such a long time.
We've no idea what's happening with Morgan. Opinion is divided. Some people seem to be interpreting his behavior of putting things on the altar and his caressing of the walker as madness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's an unhinged character who could act in random ways, whereas other people see him as someone who's very much at peace with the world and is just kind of getting on with things. He's like a really successful survivalist, you know.
I see it more as that. I don't think he's mad. I think he's using things to control.
Yeah, I didn't get the sense of anything sinister.
No.
But I thought there was something playful about him putting those things up on the altar. I mean, it's ridiculous. You come across a church and look at it, you know, things are flayed all over the place. There's weird stuff written there. It's a, and, you know, you're probably walking in there finding bottles of formula and, you know, the things that this group have left behind. It's a ridiculous scene.
Oh, totally. Totally is. But he deals with it quite well. So with Bob's death, then, going back to Bob for a second, there's a certain amount of catharsis given to the characters because they're able to say goodbyes, which is a rare thing with deaths in this show. It's an interesting take. We haven't seen that pretty much since season one, when they left that one fellow by the tree.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name now, but...
Jim?
Jim, that's it. Yeah, Jim. Yeah. That's right. So we haven't seen that in a very long time. Characters usually die pretty fast. I mean, Dale had a few moments on the ground while he was gurgling out his life's blood, but it's rare. So Bob says goodbye, Bob dies. Beth, however, doesn't even really get a chance to say hello again to everybody before she's saying goodbye.
No,
she says goodbye.
She's only got herself to blame.
Yes, because what the hell was she thinking? We see her sticking a paramedical scissors into her cast as she's going off to, like, why would you do that, Beth? Obviously, this is the gun over the mantelpiece, right? This is the Chekhov moment. He did state that if you put a gun over the mantelpiece in the first act, it must be fired by the third act.
Yeah.
And that's to paraphrase. And here you've got her putting the scissors into her cast with about 20 minutes left to go in the episode, but you know something's going to go wrong. As soon as you see that, you know. I mean, you knew ahead of time because you saw the name of the episode and you'd already kind of parsed out the fact that Coda is the end of the song, right?
Yeah, it made sense to me. So, although, you know, like we said, with their use of the previews, they're not above giving us misleading details.
Oh, you think?
So speaking of death, Steve, I guess it's time to talk about the demise of tonight's episode because I think we need to call it.
I think so. I felt I died a little bit during the quiz earlier, actually. So, I really enjoyed this first episode. It was fun. It was great. I think we should do that more often. Yeah. I'm going to do that to you next time.
Yeah,
I
don't know. Actually, you should quiz me.
I'm just going to do it randomly.
That would be truly funny.
Yeah, it was a really, really great first half. Because of the first three in the last episode, there was a bit of unevenness in the middle. But I think, I said episode, I meant season. Sorry. I think that this is a really strong overall eight episodes, though, for the first half of the season. How about you?
I honestly think it's still my favorite season so far.
I've got no expectations leading into the next half, except that I hope there's more good stuff. And we'll talk about that in a few weeks when we do our preview show.
We will. And speaking about the next few weeks, we are going to continue bringing shows over every week until The Walking Dead starts up again. And next week, I believe, we have a Christmas special in line.
We do.
And we are going to be talking about alternative Christmas movies.
Absolutely. Things that you might not think of on the top of your list, such as, you know, your typical Christmas carols or Wonderful Lives. I hope you guys have a great week in between. And Dan, as always, this was a pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure, Steve.
Love the talk.
All right, happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, too.